researching questions at the end of each paper. Since I'm not, they are saved that experience. So I'd like to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Natalia Lidova. From the Russian Academy of Sciences. Her field is Natyashastra and ancient Indian theatre, normally speaking, but she's going to speak to us today on Yajna and Puja, a comparison of the ritual archetypes.
Yeah. So now, unfortunately, you will have another paper without visual representation. And I do hope that it will be not so boring for you. So, a comparison of the ritual archetypes. The correlation between Yajna and Puja may well be one of the most complicated problems in Indology. Yajna held pride of place as a solemn rite in the Vedic time, while Puja became widespread in the post-Vedic era to become the central ritual of Hinduism. Many scholars cling to the idea of a Vedic origin of Puja, regarding it as a yajna, which went through specific transformation, though no substantiated explanation of the supposed changes have yet appeared. As we can assume, yajna and puja coexisted within Vedic culture as two rituals mutually equivalent status, and the middle first millennium BC merely started to gradually alter the former and give a dominant position to the latter. This assumption, however, clashes with one simple fact. Puja is not described in any ritual text of the Vedic era, which means that this type of adoration was perfectly alien to the Vedic Brahmanic ritualism. More than that, the root puja extremely rarely occurs in the Vedic text. Descriptions of puja appear in texts from quite a different time. Medieval ritual text whose most generalist name is the Agnus. The oldest of these texts had not emerged before 5th, 6th century AD. They have recorded already rather an advanced stage of development of the puja cult, the first mentions of which concern a much earlier epoch, the middle of the first millennium BC. We can state that one of the early detailed descriptions of puja was saved in the Natyashastra, a treatise on theatrical arts forming throughout centuries and existing as a canonical text as early as 1st, 2nd century AD. In this, we can assume it as proof that the ritual mythological strata of the Natyashastra had taken shape far earlier, possibly in the middle of the first millennium BC. The early dating of the Natyashastra was suggested, above all, by scholars related to the publication of its text, the French Sanskritologist Paul Rimion and Indian scholar Manmohan Ghosh. Without dwelling here on just why the specialized treatise on the drama preserved one of the most ancient descriptions of puja, we shall concentrate our attention on another major problem, whether yajna and puja were genetically linked, or whether they were rituals totally independent of each other. Above, we noted attempts to compare yajna and puja. Some emphasizes the similarities between the two, others brought out the differences. Irrespective of this, all scholars proceeded from comparison between the outward aspects of the ritual practice with extremely vague results. More than that, there were a sophisticated religious system behind each of these two rituals with a multitude of rites, some of them much different between themselves. It is impossible to compare all rites without exception, while a selective comparison was not representative enough. A comparison of rituals appears to be destined for success only if it proceeds from a specific methodological approach, which allows compare not the outward aspects of rites, but ritual principles underlying them. Here our task is reduced to the identification of what we may conventionally term the ritual archetype as the basis of yajna and puja. As I see it, the most silent features of a ritual archetype are determined by three principal aspects, which can be put into the form of three queries. The first, where, pertains to arrangement of the ritual space. The second, how, to the type of the offering. And the third, what for, describes the ritual goals of the worship. So, where? As we know, in the Vedic cult, all rites performed in the open. The principal ritual structure was the altar, represented the terrestrial world and the earth. This identification is of tremendous importance, since the earth was merely one zone of the threefold Vedic universe, which consisted of the terrestrial, aerial, and celestial spheres. Rites of puja used a mandala instead of the altar, instead of an altar, to arrange the ritual space. The mandala, a sacral circle, was totally unknown to the Vedic times. Of pivotal importance is the fact that the mandala used in puja did not merely replace the Vedic altar. This is borne out not so much by their outward difference as by the essential difference between their semantics. As we have just pointed out, the Vedic altar represented only the earth, while the mandala symbolized the entire universe. Its circle stood for the visible borderline of cosmos. The center coincided with the center of the universe, while the vertical represented the symbolical universal axis and the urban mundi at the same time. As they treated the mandala as the model of the universe, the Agamic text ordered it precisely oriented on the four cardinal points quartered by the Lakapalas, which were thoroughly alien to the Vedic altar, usually oriented on the east. Post-Vedic culture made the mandala the basic structure-building symbol used to arrange all kinds of sacral space, viewed as an integrated cosmos created around a predetermined center. The Vedic culture knew no temples. Their emergence and sweeping spread in the Hindu era is now interpreted by scholars as the pivotal difference between yajna and puja ritualism, now as a natural evolution of the idea of the Vedic altar. This particular context makes it essentially important that the construction of any Hindu temple was directly linked to the mandala. An invisible mandala lay at the foundation of the temple and was used as schematic representation of cosmos only on a horizontal plane, while the temple unfolded it vertically, like a sacrificial pillar. It is of tremendous importance that the temple succeeded the sacral content of the mandala as the image of the universe, and so different from the Vedic altar, not only in architecture, but semantics. How? The Vedic religion, based on fire worship, brought its offering mainly by burning. It is characteristic of many non-iconic cults within the various religious traditions of the ancient world. As we know, the Vedic religion did not recognize effigies of deities. The gods were ideal presences at the altar, unseen substances who attended the sacrificial worship. As I see it, the very absence of divine effigies determined the pivotal features of the sacrifice. A physically palpable offering could not be presented to the unseen gods, so it had to be stripped of flesh and turned into a sacrificial substance or quintessence, which could shed a greater part of its earthly properties and the square properties of the divine world. To this demand, fire owed its exceptionally elevated status. Only a physically destroyed offering, wholly devoured by Agni's flame, could embody a gift complete and irretrievable. Vedic theology ascribes a universal scope to the dualism of fire and sacrifice, which determines the most esoteric premises of this religion. In puja rituals, the sacrifice of flowers, incense, food, and water is usually offered without fire as intermediary. The offerings are merely piled at the foot of a statue of a god or an object symbolizing him. As I see it, the difference of sacrifices is directly rooted in the fact that Yajna was non-iconic cult, while puja embodied the adoration of a visible image of God. It may appear not so important at first sight whether one brings an offering to unseen God or his worshipped image. In essence, however, this aspect determines two thoroughly different paradigms of the ritual mentality. The unseen God demands a fleshless sacrifice as the fire devours it. A God actually present, on the contrary, can be offered a visible and physically palpable gift. In this sense, the presence or absence of the effigy or symbol of God may be regarded as the heart of the matter, not merely interconnected with the pivotal qualities of the ritual archetype, but something that determines these qualities. The essentially important difference determined, among other features, the less esoteric quality of puja ritualism as compared to the Vedic. The ritualism treated gods not as inconceivable substances, but as physical entities, immortal by nature, but involved in the rotation of time, with its cycle of slumber, wakefulness, dressing, repast, and entertainment. Of the latter, the principal were music, songs, and dances, directly connected with the tradition of ancient Indian theater described in the Natya Shastra. What for? The Vedic ritual was always ordered by a particular donor, Yajamana. The Yajamana was the starting point of the ritual, which could not take place at all without one. Such personal messages were alien to puja rituals. The performance of puja never depended on a particular donor. It was a cyclic ritual which took place every day and in exceptional conditions could be performed without any worshippers present. The easy access to it is among the key aspects of puja ritualism. Not only twice born, but all the faithful without exception could attend the sacrifice. This concerned women, shudras, and persons of the mixed caste. We can assume that as puja was spreading in the Aryan milieu, the social strata, which had never before been admitted to the performance of many Vedic rituals, now became involved in the community's religious life. As this comparison shows, the ritualism of Yajna and puja never coincided in any of the basic aspects of religious practice, which determines the type of the arrangement of the ritual space, the way of bringing the offering, and the ritual goals of the adoration. As I see it, it gives us sufficient ground to assume that Yajna and Puja ascended to different ritual archetypes with different sacrificial structures and symbolism. The boundaries of this presentation do not allow me to dwell in detail on the similarities between Yajna and Puja rituals. Shows that Puja rites emerge not in isolation from the Vedic ritual culture, but inherited numerous elements from it, including a well-known Vedic rite, Homa. Another long-standing question, Whether and under what circumstances the ancient Indian ritual system was transformed to make puja, not yajna, the basic form of sacrifice. The early puja tradition, to all appearances, have Brahma for supreme god. The initial stage of the puja cult, close to the time of its inception, is in fact reflected in the ritual and mythological chapters of the Natya Shastra. As I try to show in my papers, quite long paper, I do hope that you could see it on a conference website. The closest analog to the Natya Shastra rites is the Brahma Yaga, a Brahma worship described in Atharva Veda Parishishta 19b. This Parishishta never translated in any European language, so in my paper it's detailed translation explanation of this ritual. The consecration of new seed is the closest analog of the Brahma Yaga among the Natya Shastra rituals. These rituals are extremely close to each other, not only symbolically, but structurally. We even observe in the Brahma Yaga the stages of seeda consecration. The Natya Shastra ritual starts with a ceremony allowing to consecrate the ritual building as a whole. The Brahma Yaga starts similarly, with X consecrated the mandapa, which has just been built. The same ritual puja was performed with this goal on both instances, to give the earthly structure the status of a sacral building, the temple. The interior of both structures was arranged in conformity with the pattern characteristic to a majority of puja rituals. It had a precisely emphasized center, which symbolized the center of the sacral space and was oriented on the cardinal and midway points. The Acharya of the Natya Shastra himself drew the mandala in the center of the stage. Likewise, the Brahmin performing the Brahma Yaga make a mandala in the mandapa center. Then Acharya placed Brahma seated in the lotus in the center of the mandala, while the Atharva Vedic priest placed Brahma Parameshvara in the center of the lotus whose image he had made. It is of tremendous importance that none of this text mentions idols, so they do not suppose to use an anthropomorphous images of gods, an oblique proof of both fixing approximately the same developmental stage of the puja cult. The installation of the supreme god Brahma in the center of the mandala preceded the beginning of the principal part of the ritual, when the longest and the most solemn puja was performed in both rituals. The solemn puja over, the priest opened the next stage of the ritual, the royal rite with homa performed at the start. In the Natya Shastra ritual of seeda consecration, the king appeared on the stage accompanied by seven girl dancers made up as goddesses, Saptamatikas. He took part in the ceremony performed for his well-being with numerous perfusion and recitals of blessing mantras. Practically the same was taking place in the Brahma Yaga. The king was repeatedly sprinkled and anointed with prayers for his luck and well-being. He also surrounded by women who were holding mirrors, beautiful fans, and singing wondrous songs. The coincidence between theater consecration and Brahma Yaga are too great not to assume not only typological, but also direct genetic links. The latter assumption does not appear implausible if we consider that Atharva Veda Parishishta 19b supplements Atharva Veda Parishishta 19, which describes the ritual of the Indra festival, while the Natya Shastra contains a mythological account of the Indra festival, of which the first drama was performed. Possibly, ascending to the festival of Indra was only the idea of synthesizing the ritual and the entertainment, an idea fruitful enough to be considered as the cornerstone of the puja tradition, which accounted for the profound theatralization of post-Vedic culture. This is just short abstract, short summary of the paper. Main thing which I try to show if after the comparison of the ritual archetype, this is the nearest analog to the Nadya Shastra rites, because it appeared like an empty space. We cannot connect this tradition to any text or any milieu or any historical tradition. So this closeness is interesting enough to find this opportunity.
Thank you very much. I think that nobody will disagree with your very fine characterization of yajna and puja as things originally and basically entirely different. I'd just like to introduce into the discussion the word metaphor. Yajna is, of course, the most prestigious ritual activity in India, became a metaphor permeating the civilization. For instance, the Jajmani system of North India, all based on the metaphor of the yajna and how that operates.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, the word even puja, totally different though it is often metaphorically called a yajna, and the same with the corresponding verbs. Just think of devo bhutva devim yajet, which is really puja. I mean, in fact, you do a puja to the devi, you don't do a Vedic yajna. So I'm just saying that puja is metaphorically called yajna, though not, I think, ever the other way around.
Again, it's a matter of how we treat yajna and puja. If we treat them as just type of offering, and we can consider that they're almost the same, yeah? So we can use another word to determine the same ritual process, just to worship gods. This is one point. But if we try to decide, is it the same or different? Is it two different archetypes and different rituals? This is the most important thing for me. For example, I came to this very simply. Professor Köper, he's a brilliant scholar, wrote an excellent book, which is Varuna and Vidushika, tried to show that Natya Shastra ritual is completely Vedic. And it has the Vedic origin, and he always uses terminology, yajna, 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 or puja, is a synonym. So when I study text, I never find a term yajna in the Natya Shastra. It's never uses terminology. And it's from another side, it's a lot of Vedic features in the treatise itself, which use Köper to prove his ideas concerning Vedic origin of theater and Natya Shastra itself. So for me, it's very crucial and very important to show not the similarities of the process of worshiping gods, but the difference between the way of worshiping and the idea which is underlying. This is the matter. So for me, it's...
One more question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Are you interpreting the puja or ritual in Natya Shastra according to Abhinava Gupta or the actual text?
Actual text.
I haven't read your larger paper, but have you commented on Yantra, Pindivandha, Bhadrasana? These are the rituals that take place after Jarjara Puja. And those are explained by Abhinava Gupta. And they do not, I don't know, I have to read your paper.
Yeah,
But
does
it not match with the Brahma Yajna that you are talking about, so I have to read and then...
Yeah, it's, let us discuss later, maybe.
It's not Abhinavagupta's...
No, it's not Abhinavagupta interpretation.
But in the Purvaranga, where fifth or fourth even, end of the fourth chapter, we do not have that kind of description.
Yeah, of course. And we even can find 16 stages puja, like late puja in the Natya Shastra. Definitely Natya Shastra preserve very, very early stage of puja call. When they don't have a space which they keep all the time, they just create this sacral space, perform the ritual, and then dissolve it, and this is very important. And as far as Purvaranga is concerned, first of all, it's different rituals. The ritual of the consecration of the theater, which is one of what is very close to Brahma Yaga. Another is Purvaranga itself. And Purvaranga, as I try to show, it's some kind of Indra festival, but in short, on schematic time. Because if we are talking about this Indra festival, what is the main point of this festival? It's just adoration of this vertical. And it's absolutely the same in Purvaranga. It's actually the ritual of increasing adoration, and then it's of vertical, which is Jhajjara. And then they create this mandala on the stage, and so on and so on. Worship Lakapalas, offer gift on these four cardinal points, and so on and so on.
So this promises to be a long discussion, which will have to be postponed to an informal context.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd just like to thank Dr. Vidova for her. Devangana Desai is the editor of the Journal of the Asiatic Society of Bombay and Associate of Bombay University. And she tells me she's also editing books on World Heritage Sites in India for Oxford University Press. So,
thanks. Kajurahu, I think most of you know your
work. She's speaking of textual tradition and the temples of Kajurahu.
Khajuraho flourished under the Chandela Rajput dynasty between 10th and 12th centuries, and highly evolved and refined temples were built here by the royal family and Jain merchants. And we examine here these magnificent temples to see how their art and architecture are linked up with the textual tradition, both Vastu texts and the religious texts, such as the Puranas, the Shaivagamas, and Pancharatras, dealing with rituals and religious action. The site turned into a great temple town from about the middle of the 10th century, and there are 25 temples that survive now out of the traditional 85 built in the area of about 13 square kilometers. And in addition, there are 50 mounds which the archaeological survey have identified. And actually, they have identified 18 mounds for excavation, but have actually dealt with only two mounds, partially exposed only two mounds, which contain architectural remains of temples. And the top temples occupy, you see here the aerial view, the Lakshmana temple, which is dedicated to Vishnu Vaikuntha, associated with Pancharatra system, and the Kandariya Mahadev, which we will, both of these temples we will be referring to in this lecture. And this is the aerial view. You can see how Shiva and Vishnu temples distant near each other. And you can see here, the temples are divided into three zones. The western zone near the Shiv Sagar tank, the where the Rawal family built temples, the Lakshmana, Kandariya, and other temples, the Varaha temple there. Then in the eastern zone, near Kharjur Sagar Lake, Jain merchants built temples, the Parshvanath, Adinath, and other temples. And in the southern zone, near the Khuda Rivulet, there are both Shiva and Vishnu temples. And recently, this temple has been exposed here, the Bija Mandal Mound, which is a Vaidyanatha temple originally. We get accounts of Khajuraho in 1335 by Ibn Battuta, and in 1838 by Captain Burt, who has given a very colorful report of these temples, and then later Major Cunningham in his Archaeological Survey of India has described in detail the temples. The Lakshmana temple, the Lakshmana temple or the Vaikuntha temple, it enshrines this image of Vishnu, the composite image of Vishnu as Vaikuntha, which is an esoteric form, and it was worshipped by the followers of the Pancharatra of the Kashmir school. And therefore, this Pancharatra text, which we study, help us in the iconic for studying the iconic scheme of the temple. The patrons. By mid-10th century, the Chandela family became powerful and amassed wealth and ruled vast territory called Jejakabukti. About 66 inscriptions of this dynasty have been found. In Khajuraho, 3 large inscriptions in Sanskrit language have been found. And they patronized not only the temples, but also encouraged poetry, drama, dance, and music. And they were rasikas, connoisseurs of art. Two of the rulers were themselves poets, and court culture and sophisticated ethos is reflected in the art of Khajuraho temples. And on the right we see, a maiden, Naika, with a manuscript in hand. She's making some gesture to explain it. So the temples were constructed in the Nagara style of architecture, which is an elegant style. Architects followed the Vishwakarma school of Vastu Shastra, to which I'll be shortly coming to, and the religious texts such as the Purana, Shaivagamas, and Pancharatras influenced the placement of images in temples. Now it may be noted that the religious systems associated with these major temples were concerned not only with theology and yoga, not only with the doctrinal aspects, but also with the practical side of religion. They have a Kriyapada section dealing with the building of temples and the making of images and with the performing of the rituals. Knowledge of puja and vidhis is necessary for the temple builder for creating space in the structure and for sthana nirnaya, or placement of images. So for this reason, we also get information from these texts when studying these temples. Now this is the Vishwanatha temple of Khajuraho, which was built in AD 999 by the Chandela king Danga. And it has an inscription in embellished Sanskrit language full with puns. Each of its verse has double meanings. And this temple, the inscription mentions its architect, Shichcha. And it is also mentioned there that he was well-versed in the Vishwakarma Shastra. So the inscription mentions the association of the temple temple's architect with this Vastu text of Vishwakarma. And here, this is the terminology on the right. We see this Vastu Shastra terminology of the Khajuraho temple. Each part from the ground level, from the Jagati platform up to the spire, it has its name from the Vastu texts. Next, please. Oh, sorry. Because I'm used to that. I'm used to that. Not to this. Okay. Now, Kandarya Mahadev Temple, it is a Lopsi Shikara spire with 84 turrets or mini shikaras, these. And here in the text called Shilpa Ratnakara, you get a type of shikara called of the Airavata temple with 85 turrets. So here there are 84 plus 1, that is 85 turrets, and here there are this temple, Airavata temple. So there is similar, there is resemblance with the Vastu terminology and the Vastu text. Now, door of the temple. We have from Brihat, from the time of Brihat Samhita and Vastu texts, prescription of auspicious motifs to be depicted on door gems of the temple. Parul mentioned about the Lalata Bimba, this part where the main divinity is always depicted. In her case, it was Durga Shemankari. In this case, it is Vishnu's consort Lakshmi who is depicted on this. But on the door gem, generally auspicious motifs are depicted. But here, there are some special depictions. There are avatars of Vishnu, which are depicted: Matsya, Kurma, fish and tortoise, Varaha, Narsimha, Vaman, Parshuram. And this prescription you find in the Pancharatra text, Hayashesha Pancharatra. So that has helped us to study the door of these temples. And the worship of the divinities of the door, Dwara Devatas, is advocated in the religious texts such as the Jayakya Samhita, Hayashirsha Pancharatra, Lakshmi Tantra, which Dr. Sayuka Gupta has edited and translated, Agni Purana, Ishana Shiva Guru Deva Paddhati, and others. These texts provide krama or successive order of the worship, giving mantras for worship of the threshold divinities, followed by the mantras for worship of the river goddesses who are stationed there, and Dwarapalas, the doorkeepers. And we see these figures represented at the entrance of Khajuraho temples, this temple as well as other Shiva and even Jain temples. Auspicious mithunas or couples were decorated the door of the Indian temple since 4th 5th century AD. And for that we have prescriptions in the text. Khajuraho architects place couples on doors. They also place them on the walls, plinth and other places. But they have assigned a special place to erotic figures on the juncture walls, joining the hall and the sanctum of the temple, as we will see in the next slide. And for this, I could not find any textual prescription of placing figures in conjunction on the juncture walls. But they have specially made the distinction between the Sandhara temples with inner pradakshina. There is inner pradakshina here. These are the Sandhara temples, and this is the Nirandhara temple without inner pradakshina. So they have made this distinction, and here if you see two squares overlap on the part which joins the juncture of the hall, Mahamandapa, and the sanctum. On this portion, which can be taken from the side of the hall as well as side of the sanctum, they have placed figures in conjunction on the Sandhi Kshetra. And they have made puns and used double meaning language, and I won't go into detail of this. That requires a set of different slides. But I just want to point out that they have made this distinction of placement of figures in conjunction on the Sandhara temples and the Nirandhara temples, and that we can see here. This is a Nirandhara temple without Inna Pradakshina, the Vaman temple, and here they put divinities in niches. Whereas on the Vishwanatha temple, this which is a Sandhara temple, they put these erotic figures or figures in conjunction. And there are also head-down poses on two of these temples, two Shiva temples, the Vishwanatha temple as well as the Kandariya Mahadev. And while drawing the lines on their photographic reproductions, the geometry in their compositional scheme reminded me of the Kamakala Yantra of the Orissan text Shilpa Prakasham. According to this text, this was a protective yantra, the lines of which were to be concealed from non-initiates by placing erotic figures. That is, the figures, the Mithunamurtis, they are supposed to conceal the lines of the yantra so that the non-initiates can only see the erotic figures, and which would in turn give them delight. The figures would be for delight to people, as this text says. And based on this observation, we can say that the erotic figures and the yantra that they seem to conceal were believed to magically protect the building against obstacles. So there are multiple functions of sexual symbolism, and I won't go into detail here. And I think there is a paper by Dr. David Smith on erotic figures, mainly dealing with Khajuraho. The two prominent motifs of Khajuraho, Apsara or celestial female, and Vyalas or griffins. Now, different types of Vyalas or griffins are described in Vastu texts. I think we saw some of them in Parul's slides of the Jagat temple. The Aparajita Pritcha, the text, it creates 16 into 16, that is 256 varieties of Vyalas by permutation and combinations of heads and bodies of different animals and birds. And this is helpful in looking at the varieties of Vyalas of the Khajuraho temples. And regarding the motif of Apsara or celestial maiden, the Vastu texts such as the Orissan Shilpa Prakasha and the Western Indian text Shirarnava give detailed classifications of 16 and 32 types respectively, along with their descriptions, such as Darpana holding a mirror, Nupura Padika as you see here, tying ankle bells, Patralekha writing a letter, and so on. This typology helps us to name some of the Apsaras of the Khajuraho temples. However, there is a noteworthy theme much favored by the Khajuraho artists, namely the female figure with a scorpion on her leg, which is not found or listed in any of the textual classification of the Apsara. And that is, I think, an invention of the Khajuraho artists, though later it is found at other places also. The Orissan text Shilpa Prakasham says that it gives 16 types of Apsaras or Alasakanyas, such as Nupurapadika and others, and it states, which is important to, and I will read out, it states, as a house without a wife, as frolic without a woman, so without a figure of a woman, the monument will be of inferior quality and bear no fruit. So the artists, this prescription is important, and they have shown Apsaras on the temple walls. You will find them in most of the temples built in Nagara style and also in the Dravida style of architecture. Now there are divinities holding manuscripts in hand. You see these texts they are holding. They are handsome figures with jata, and they have different vahanas or mounts. There is a hansa mahana, a goose, There is a Rev Vahanam or mount, and these were not earlier identified. There are six of them along with Surya encircling the Lakshmana or Vaikuntha temple like this. These six divinities, they were not identified, but on the basis of one of them having the frog mount, this one, I could identify this as planet Shukra, because when I looked up the iconography of the Prajapatis, Dikpalas and other mythological figures, nothing could fit in with these divinities and the mounts which they are having. So it is the frog as the Vahana which gave me a clue to the figure being the planet Shukra or Venus. For frog is a mount of planet Shukra in the sculptural depictions of central and eastern India. There are panels showing in Navagrahas, there are panels with Shukra shown as with frog mount. And also in the textual tradition of the Western Indian texts Aparajita Pritcha and Rupa Mandana. So the figure with the frog mount represents Shukra. The rest of the six figures and Surya, being group of collective divinities, would also represent the other grahas of planetary divinities. And what is important is, this is how they are placed. There is Ganesh there, Durga there, Surya here, and those are the six divinities which were not earlier identified. But these divinities, these are the planetary divinities, they are all, this is the place on the plinth of the temple. So they are almost encircling the temple. And this is as if they are forming a graha mandala around the temple. And further, of great significance is this imagery of the grahas encircling the temple, for it makes the temple image as Mount Meru, the cosmic mountain in the center of the universe, around which the planets revolve. I mean, even if you open a dictionary, you will see Meru around which the planets revolve. So this is a cosmic imagery which we would miss if we do not have knowledge of iconography in order to identify the images and see their configuration in the temple scheme and perceive the intimacy of the sutradharas or artist's ideas and the visualization into his design of the temple. Now, architects, according to the Samarangana Sutradhara, they were supposed to be well-versed in mathematics, astronomy, astrology, philosophy, arts, etc. But it is also possible that they were guided by gurus or acharyas, particularly in matters of placement of images, thana nirnaya, and in requirements of temple worship. In my paper, I have given some textual and also epigraphical evidence on this point. And a very significant sculptural depiction is panel is recently excavated from the Bijamandal mound of Khajuraho, one of the mounds recently exposed by the archaeological survey. And here you see on this an acharya seated with a manuscript in hand. There is a scribe or writer, and there are these artisans holding an object. So it seems that he is giving instructions to the writer here, the acharya. There are sculptural representations of the acharyas, here again, holding a manuscript in hand. And this one, Acharya Someshwara Bhattaraka, this one is inscribed, there is an inscription there, though his head is not there. You can imagine sitting in yoga position, very straight, body position. And such acharyas were revered at Khajuraho. And there is Acharya Urdhva Shiva. His name is inscribed here on this stone sculpture. His name Urdhva Shiva suggests his affiliation to the Shaiva system, and he installed this extraordinary image of the four-legged or Chatushpada Sadashiva. Which this image is now in the Khajuraho Museum. And by way of a pun, Chatushpada, which means 4 feet, padas, and which also suggests four parts of a treatise, like Jnanapada, knowledge, Charyapada, conduct or daily rituals, Kriyapada, activities, methods of worship, and Yogapada, meditation, etc. So Acharya Udvashiva installed this image, and which suggests of the Shaiva system. Now, I just gave very briefly of the Shaiva system, because I think in iconic scheme, in the images, there is this influence of the system. The concept of far-reaching importance in the religious system of the period was that of the emanation or emission of cosmic elements, tattvas, from the Supreme Being in the process of creation of the universe and their reabsorption to the primordial center in the process of dissolution. There is a hierarchy of cosmic elements or divinities, one emanating from the other previous one, as in a chain, from the formless Supreme Being to the earth element in the evolution process and the return to the primordial center in the process of dissolution. And there is this doctrinal unfolding which has been noticed by scholars, Professor Stella Krembrich and Doris Srinivasan, in some well-planned Shiva temples of early India. They have noticed this doctrinal unfolding at three levels. Shiva as Shiva Linga, as representing the unmanifest, the formless aspect of Shiva, or avyakta, manifest, unmanifest, vyakta vyakta, or sakala nishkala sadashiva. This is another Sadashiva image. We saw one four-footed image, this is the other one, in the Kandariya Mahadev temple, and Shiva as Mahesha in his various forms, about 26 Leela Murtis as Mahesha, Shiva as dancer, as bridegroom, Shiva vanquishing demons, etc. So this is the third aspect of Shiva. So there is this hierarchy, and in addition, we also find in the Kandariya Mahadev other manifestations also, the still lesser manifestations of the Shiva pantheon, in the hundreds of images of Shiva which are on the exterior wall of the temples. Now, Shiva Linga in the sanctum, which is Shiva Linga in the Chandela inscription, is described as Jagataha Moola Stambha, the primordial pillar of the universe, and it is installed exactly in the center of the Garbhagruha, and above it is the spire, finial, and there is this cosmic axis, if you join the line, from the ground level to the finial, Akasha, the sky. So this vertical axis is the cosmic axis, and the nucleus of the Garbhagruha is crucial, like the bindu at the center of the yantra, and it can be compared to a spider which is linked to different parts in its web. And the well-known simile of Brahman, the ultimate reality, likened to a spider in the Upanishadic and Puranic literature, helps us to understand the notion of the potential all point. The spider emits and reabsorbs threads from his body. Similarly, all the different parts of the web are interconnected, and similarly, the nucleus of the Garbhagruha is the metaphysical and physical center of the temple, and it is on this center of energy that the linga is installed. And images of Shaiva hierarchy, they are arranged in relation to the linga. So the unfoldment from the central principle can be seen in the form of evolutes or manifested images which are placed hierarchically in relation to the center. And the centrifugal movement radiates in four cardinal directions in the temple in the form of the images. I think Adam Hardy is also going to speak something of that point. We see images of Sadashiva manifest, unmanifest in the hall. Mahesha's different forms or Leela Murtis and Rudra, and similar and still lesser anshas of factions in the rank of Shaiva hierarchy. Now, on rituals and temple space, I have, in context of this, I have quoted from Richard Davis, who has worked on various Shaiva, I quoted in my paper on various Shaiva rituals recorded in medieval texts and actually performed as aids to worshipper in bridging the distance between the transcendent, formless, unmanifest Shiva and the graded manifestations. Rich Davis says that the temple is an emanated structure unfolding from its center, and space within the temple is organized as a concentric hierarchy with the most exalted areas located at or nearest the center. And to approach the prominent deity in the linga, the worshipper necessarily begins outside the temple walls and gradually approaches the inner sanctum, moving from the periphery to the center of the ritual space, and hence he follows the order of reabsorption. So the temple, with its integrated imagery, is an ordered whole representing the doctrinal unfolding in its graded iconic scheme.
You have 5 more minutes.
Wait, it will be over within that. I think I missed one image. Yeah. The architect of the Kandariya Mahadev temple has meticulously programmed images on the walls of the sanctum. There are 8 dikpalas in the corners. Dikpalas are the regions of space, 8 vasus or astral divinities, 12 vyalas or griffins, 24 mithunas and 36 surasundaris or apsaras and Shiva's manifestations, systematically placed on the 3 walls of the sanctum. You can see this, the way they are placed. The sanctum is conceived as a mandala, consecrated sacred space, in the puja rites performed by the aspirant at the entrance according to the Shaiva religious text Ishana Shiva Guru Deva Padati and in the Vayavya Samhita of the Shiva Purana. The sanctum of the temple is guarded on 8 corners by the dikpalas or 8 directions. Now, the positioning of the dikpalas agrees well with the prescription of the Vastu text like Aparajita Prucha, but the significance can be understood from the ritual text, which advise the ritual for removal of vignas or obstacles from the 8 directions and mentally invoking and placing the dikpalas there to guard against evils, so that evils don't come in. Therefore, they put dikpalas there. After performing various rites, the aspirant then enters the Garbhagruha Mandala, I'm using the word of the text, Garbhagruha Mandala, that is sanctum in the form of the mandala, as the Ishana Shiva Guru Deva Paddhati states. Now, and this is my last line now. Cave-like and mountain-like, the great Kandariya Mahadev stands majestically. It is not only architecturally magnificent, but it is conceptually remarkable. And to conclude, we have seen the textual and architectural correspondence of Khajuraho temples and examined some of these cultural motifs in relation to Vastu texts. Along with the Vastu texts, the role of religious texts in temples imagery and symbolism is quite significant. Religious texts throw considerable light on the meaning of temple imagery, the hierarchical forms of the unmanifest, the name and form, nama rupa, of the formless, expressing the temple as a model of the cosmos. The Kandariya Mahadev, one of the highly evolved temples of India, can be seen as enacting the drama of cosmic emanation and dissolution conveyed in its iconic scheme as well as in its formal structure. And in my paper, I have referred to Adam Hardy's approach to the temple through the formal structure. Now, staying within the textual tradition of the Vishwakarma school, the architects of Khajuraho have created new images such as 4-footed Sadashiva, new configurations like an iconic scheme such as those of planetary divinities placed around the Vishnu Vaikuntha temple, which is thus conceived as Mount Meru, the center of the universe. It seems that the architects, well-versed in the Vishwakarma Vastu tradition, worked in close association with acharyas who had grasped the religious systems affiliated to the Khajuraho temples and who infused meaning into images through their placement in the architectural scheme of the temple. Thank you.
Second time we've heard the notion of puns being associated with architecture.
I didn't follow.
Puns.
Double meaning language.
And I was just wondering whether this is.
Yeah, there is a pun because you take
yes.
it from both
yes.
the sciences.
Yes.
Michael Meister has pointed out the architectural pun by joining of the sanctum and the Garbhagriha. So that he has. But in addition to that, elsewhere I have dealt with, not in this paper, that there are puns also on figures which are carved on the that particular part. You know, it's a Sandhi Kshetra. So from both the sides you can take equally, from the site of the sanctum, from the site of the hall. So on that particular portion, they have made use of double meaning language, Sandhya Bhasha also, which I won't go into detail here, that I've dealt with in my book, The Religious Imagery of Khajuraho. So Sandhya Bhasha as well as Shlesha puns they have used.
So is this to do, is it linked with Leela, the idea of play, or
it is
Leela with the idea of play?
Leela.
So in other words, the temple is a form of play, cosmic play.
I didn't follow Leela.
Not linked with the idea of Leela or play.
No.
The architect is also, because here in England we have like, cathedrals often are the architect or the artist will put in little things which are little puns.
That could be.
And
yes.
That is quite typical, I think.
Thank you.
Again, we have to thank Dr. Desai. It's very limited. And it's my pleasure to.